If you can ever learn the secret of subliminal messaging or programming, you're really on to something. Not only will it help you in your day-to-day business, relationships, I'm telling you, it works. Advertisers have been using it on us for a number of years. In a moment, Leonard Mlodinow joins us again as we talk about his latest work, Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Leonard Mlodinow with us. Leonard, subliminal. Tell us a little bit about what subliminal means.
Well, subliminal means below the threshold, and in this case, below the threshold of consciousness. So there are many things that happen in our environment that our mind takes in through our senses, but that our conscious mind is not aware of. Things that we notice, but we notice on an unconscious level. And they have a huge effect on our thoughts, our perceptions, our feelings, our decisions. And so it's important to understand how we work that way.
And I was going to say, if somebody is able to grasp subliminal messaging, and it doesn't always have to be, you know, in the old days it was a frame of film that an advertiser would pop in, or, you know, a quick little voice thing or something like that. But in day-to-day life, if people understood how you could subliminally get a point across to an individual, to a boss, in a relationship, it will work, won't it?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, there have been a lot of studies on that. I mean, just to pull out a random one that comes to mind, you know, touch is very important to all primates. Non-human primates spend a lot of time each day grooming each other, maybe an hour or two a day, you know, picking insects and dirt out of each other's hair. Well, that's much more than they need to spend, but they use touch to form alliances and to bond and to form trust with each other. And humans, though we don't do that, we really work in the same way. Scientists have even found certain kinds of nerves in our face and our chest that seem to be designed just to transmit this, not to really feel like what you're touching, but to transmit this pleasant feeling of touch. So the experiment that came to mind was this, that if you touch someone for briefly for a quarter or a half second, say on the shoulder or the forearm, a very subtle touch that they won't, usually don't remember later or don't even notice.
Don't even notice you're doing it.
Don't even notice you're doing it. Not a grope. It will cause them to feel more trust, bonding with you, and more trust and be more trusting toward you. So the experiment I had in mind was they had waiters and waitresses in restaurants touch half of their customers and not touch the other half as they were interacting with them. And they found that they got 20% greater tips from the ones that they touched. And in many other realms, they've had the experiment repeated. They have people go to malls and ask and pretend that they're taking surveys and stop people and say, can I have 5 minutes of your time for the survey? They increased by about 50%. About 40% of the people they approached agreed when they didn't touch them, and when they did, 60% agreed to spend 5 minutes for them. And in France, of course, the study they did had to do with picking up girls. So they had handsome young men stand on a street corner and proposition single young women who walked by. And the men were actors, and they were trained to say exactly the same thing to all the women, but to half of them they touched and the other half they didn't. And they asked for their phone number, so they have to go to work, but I'll call you later, would that be okay? And they got 10% of the women gave them their phone numbers without the touch, and with the touch, 20% did. So,
double.
Yeah, double. So this is a subliminal persuasion because people don't remember or notice the touch. And the few that did, they did exit interviews. They interviewed people after the interaction was over, and they stopped them, and they said, this is really an experiment. This is what it was about. And did you notice the touch? And then if they did notice it, they said, well, did that influence your tip? It influenced giving the phone number? And they all would laugh and said, of course not. But obviously,
because they didn't even know.
They didn't even know. Well, yeah. The few that did remember being touched said, yeah, I remember. He touched my arm, you know. So is that what convinced you? No, of course not. But obviously, it has a big effect.
What other areas of subliminal messaging can you do in that situation besides touching? Eye contact? How many different levels are there?
Oh, many. Yeah. Okay. So I have a whole chapter on how people communicate with each other non-verbally. So, of course, as humans were evolving over the millions of years, we only had speech for tens of thousands of years, and we had to communicate with each other without speech. And our brains have evolved, and we've evolved as people to be able to communicate our feelings, our intentions to others, and also to be able to read others without really talking. And so there's aspects of your smile, of your eyes, your posture, and all these things send messages to other people. And what's interesting is that it's not conscious, just like language, much of language, spoken language, is not conscious. When I speak to you or before you speak, you don't think, what's the grammar? How do I put the sentence together? And when you hear things, you don't think about processing it. You just take in the information. And the same thing happens with nonverbal communication. We read people without even knowing, in many cases, in most cases, how we're reading them, you know, and how we're transmitting information. And we're giving them information in ways that are even beyond our control. You know, you can fake a smile, for instance, but you can't fake a true smile.
That's true.
Yeah, scientists, it's called a Duchenne smile. They found that there are certain muscles in your mouth, in your face, that and around your eyes that go into effect when you're sincere about a smile. And when you're faking a smile, you have no conscious control over those muscles, so you can't make them work. So this is all ways that we talk to each other subliminally.
Well, and also body language is very important. How many times have we seen people together, couples, for example, and their body language tells you they're not into each other?
That's right. That's right. You can read that on people. And again, you know, it's a lot of our inner, you'd be surprised how elaborate our communication is and the way we react, we interact with people. Scientists have studied people as they talk to each other, for instance, and they found that the amount of time you look at a person into their eyes as you're speaking to them, compared when you're speaking to them, compared to the amount of time you look, the percentage of time you look at into their eyes when they're speaking to you, is determined in a very precise manner by who is more socially dominant or physically dominant. So if you're talking to your boss, you have a certain kind of gazing behavior. If you're the boss, you have one kind. If you're the underling, you have the other kind. When your boss is talking to you, he has or she has one kind. When he or she's talking to a superior, he or she has a different kind of gazing behavior. And you know, I detail that in the book. It's just really amazing. And they've studied this in the context of the military, where a lieutenant might be talking to a sergeant, in a company where a person's talking to a vice president, or, you know, in all kinds of different areas. And you can actually, you can quantify it down to the percentage of time that you spend looking into someone's eyes when you're talking versus when they're talking, and they can predict that, and it's very accurate. And you're not saying to yourself, I'm going to look, I'm not going to look. You're not tuning the way you look at someone when you interact with them consciously, but you unconsciously.
Right, and it's got to be that way. Music is subliminal as well. Can it be used that way?
Yeah, well, and there was one very interesting study, for instance, in a grocery store in England where they sold wine in one aisle, and they sold both French and German wine. Thank God they didn't sell British wine. But they on alternate days, they played either German music or French music. And on the days they played German music, they sold 2/3 German wine. And on the days they played French music, they sold 2/3 French wine. And again, when the scientists intercepted people leaving the store and told them what the study was, they either didn't remember the music, it was, you know, soft background music, or they claimed that it didn't affect them. But, you know, they thought they were taking in the data on the wine, the concrete data, you know, where is it from, what kind of wine is it, how sweet is it, what's the price, and all these things, and they're consciously making a decision. But clearly, at the same time, their unconscious is working and pushing them in one way or the other, and they're not even aware of it.
Who came up with all this, Leonard? I mean, how did ad agencies back in the 60s, for example, know how to do things like this?
Well, it really went back to the 1920s, I think, when a fellow named Watson, a psychologist, went to work for an advertising firm and said, you know, in your ads, what you've been doing is you've been telling what's good about your product and trying to convince people to buy your product based on its merits, based on real data. And what he said was, instead, what you need to do is start trying to reach how they feel about your product.
Yeah.
And that's a much different thing. And so, you know, and that over the decades has gotten more and more fine-tuned to where, you know, by the time I got to the 60s, that, you know, they're all over that. And that's what, you know, so that's why I mentioned earlier, Coke, when they do brain imaging of people, well, okay, when people taste Coke and Pepsi blind, they tend to prefer Pepsi. When they know what it is, they prefer Coke. And in taste tests. So researchers did some taste tests with people in the brain imaging machine and watched their brains, you know, light up as they were doing the tasting. They found that when they taste the Pepsi, the parts of your brain they expected to light up they have to do with good tasting stuff would light up as it does with Coke. But when they drank Coke, another area also lit up, which had to do with like a warm, fuzzy, satisfied feeling, happy feeling. And that comes from those years of, you know, have a Coke and a smile and things go better with Coke. I'd like to buy the world a Coke and, you know, all the happy music and everything. And people don't realize that if you ask someone, they won't say, I'm buying Coke because of those ads. But, you know, it's subliminally influencing them. So the key here is it's below the threshold of consciousness. It actually is tasting better to them. It's tasting better because of those ads. It's not just, you know, they're not just going, oh, those ads, you know, boy, Coke, yeah, happy, yeah, I feel good. No, it actually sincerely tastes better to them.
The key to subliminal messaging, then, is not the conscious mind. It's the unconscious mind, isn't it?
Oh, it's definitely, that's the whole, it's all about that. And, you know, the subliminal persuasion really, you know, burst into popular culture in the late 50s. When a marketer was trying to promote his business, and he claimed that, as you said earlier, you could put in a frame of a message in the middle of a film and get people to do things. And that was, of course, a time when the public was very susceptible to believing something like that because, you know, mind control, we had brainwashing in those days, and the Korean War, and all, you know, the Cold War, and spies, and so people, you know, they believed it, but it turned out to be a hoax. And the funny thing is, though, even though it was a hoax, you know, it really works. Maybe not quite that approach, but these subtle ways of putting messages in someone's environment can affect the way they make decisions. You know, let me give you another example of the sun. Okay, the God put the sun in your environment. Not the person who's selling you stock, but the sun affects stockbrokers. So they did a study of this was in the 80s and 90s, before computerized trading was quite so big, but they were studying traders on Wall Street who would go to work and then go, you know, into Wall Street and do their trading. And they studied the days on Wall Street that were 100% sunny. And then they also looked at the days which were really bad weather. And they looked at, well, does the market do better on sunny days than bad weather? And indeed, it tended to increase, I think it was 24% on an annualized basis if the whole year were sunny, and about 6% if the whole year were rainy and overcast. And they've since repeated that and found that in other stock exchanges around the world, that even these highly trained professionals who are, you know, balancing this data, you know, and all those studies that they do of these different companies and the financial data and making their decisions, and really, they're being influenced by a great deal, without their knowing it, by the sun.
Let's talk a little bit then about the unconscious and the conscious mind. What's the difference, first of all?
Well, you know, traditionally, since the 19th century, when people started really thinking about the unconscious, the Freudian theory really was dominant, where people thought that the unconscious were things that you're thinking that were unpleasant, you're repressing, they're hidden from you, that you could reveal through introspection and through therapy. And in the 90s, scientists in the late 80s, and especially in the 90s, starting in the mid 90s, when these brain imaging technologies came online, scientists realized that that's not really what's going on, that there are parts of your brain that just operate outside of your consciousness, and they feed into your conscious mind. It's not that they're separate, but the thinking and the processing goes on there and then feeds in, which affects your conscious decisions without you knowing it. But there's different parts of your brain. It's very complicated. It's not like I can say, oh, the green part there is unconscious, the blue part is conscious. You know, it's very complicated. But they found that there's certain processes in your brain that go on that are just outside of your consciousness. And the reason for that is pretty clear, which is that there's certain things that we just have to be able to do effortlessly and automatically in order to survive. you know, when people were evolving and living in the wild, you know, you have to, when you see, let's say, a lion, you have to know that's a dangerous animal. You have to even know that it's a lion. You know, you have to know how far away it is, which involves taking data from two eyes and doing calculations between them, you know, to measure the distance. And if you had to stop and do the calculation consciously and figure everything out, you would have been eaten. And so you know, your senses, your hearing, your vision are mostly unconscious. Your heartbeat, your breathing, your unconscious is there to keep your basic things going. You know, and we share as humans pretty much the same brain structure and chemistry of the unconscious mind with other mammals. So that's something that all, you know, higher animals have to have just to survive. And you know, the question that scientists really wonder about is not what's the role of the unconscious, but why do we have a conscious mind?
Well, that's true. Especially if it's the unconscious mind that does everything.
Right. And, you know, there's theories on that, and it's hard to prove one way or another, and evolutionary anthropologists are studying it and trying to figure out how the brain developed and when in history. And, you know, the most convincing and interesting theory to me is that our minds, our conscious minds developed, and our brain power that we have today developed for social reasons, because human species could not survive on its own. People have to cooperate to survive. We just aren't fit enough to be loners out there in the wild. And so we have to survive in groups, and we have to do what we were talking about earlier, read other people. We have to recognize other people, you know, and we have a special part of our brain that recognizes human faces. It doesn't work, let's say, for buildings or for monkeys. And, you know, we have to be able to tell what someone's thinking, and we have to be able to guess what they think we're thinking, and what they think we're thinking they're thinking, and it goes very deep that way. And when you think about it, all that kind of social processing takes an enormous amount of brain power. So there's, you know, my favorite theory out there says that humans did not develop our brains for physics and art and literature that we, you know, use them for in civilized society today, but to understand each other better, to be able to have complex social relationships and to survive. And that's what our brain power developed for. And all this other stuff that we consider advanced today, like theoretical physics, is just a side effect of having that extra brain power in order to interact socially.
It's an amazing science, Leonard, isn't it?
It is, and it's really exciting because it's new. I mean, it really took off in the mid-90s with the new brain imaging, and you know, in the last 10 years, it was, I think, 2002 was the first meeting of a new field called social neuroscience, which applies this brain imaging and psychology to our social interactions, and so who knows what, you know, we'll discover in the future.
When you walk into a crowd and you're wearing a t-shirt and jeans, you feel comfortable, but that same person walks in wearing a suit, dark preferably, I think they get more attention, don't you?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, what's really interesting, what's really interesting and important about that is that you can't resist that. So even if you say to yourself, I know that guy is a big shot, even though he's wearing a T-shirt, or, you know, I know that guy's just wearing a suit to impress me, he's not that smart. If asked to judge what they say, they will get a bump from you one way or the other based on their clothes.
Let's talk about that, Leonard, when we come back. This is an amazing subject. Leonard Maladin now with us. His book, Subliminal, as a matter of fact, the cover of his book also has a subliminal message to it. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Have you seen our television show yet, Beyond Belief? Please do so. You can watch it 10 days free. Take advantage, by the way, of that, because you can also look at all the incredible videos that they've got. And also, you will be able to take a look at David Wilcock's new television show as well. So just simply go to GaiamTV.com/George. Let me spell it, GaiamTV.com/George. And take a look at Beyond Belief. Leonard, we're talking about how clothes can subliminally impress or, you know, create this image in somebody's mind. Let's talk a little bit more about that. How does that work? And colors, too.
Right. Well, you know, people tend to categorize. And the reason we do that is, again, to help us get along in the world. you know, even if you're, let's say, setting a table, if you treat each fork or knife as an individual, you won't be able to set the table. In fact, there was a fellow famous patient who had a stroke in a part of his brain that affected the categorization ability. He couldn't set a table. He would dwell over, you know, what is this thing? Each fork, you'd have to figure out that it was a fork. And so we have to categorize in order to get around. And, you know, and if you see a guy with a blue suit and a gun, you know what he's there for. If you see a guy with a blue suit and a cap in the front of a bus, you know what he's there for, too. So, you know, when we see people with certain uniforms or certain dress, we know from our experience, and we've absorbed this in our unconscious mind in a very automatic way, you know, we judge them a certain way. So the doctors know that, and they teach you in medical school, you know, wear a tie, you wear a white coat. That's the reason a doctor doesn't come and see you with a, you know, torn-up Budweiser T-shirt. You know, because you might be the same doctor, but you're not gonna feel that the person is as authoritative. And so, you know, the same thing, by the way, works for ethnic groups and social groups. We categorize and judge people by, for instance, their gender. I mean, there's one amazing study that you know annoys me as a physicist. But they went to a university and told the class. That the professor was out that day, and they would have a substitute professor. And the substitute professors, however, were not real professors. The students didn't know this. They were fake professors. They were actors who were reading a script, a preset script, and writing equations on a board as they were taught to, according to following a script. And half the classes, this substitute professor was a male, and half it was a female. And the classes got obviously exactly the same lecture from both of these, substitute professors. But after the class, the students were asked to fill out an evaluation. How well did your substitute know the subject? How clearly did he or she speak? And so forth, explain it. And guess what? The males got rated much higher than the females, even though they said the same things and wrote the same equations. And that's because they are being judged by their gender. People have these built-in prejudices. And even the women in the classes judge the men, you know, the male professor better than the female, because they're not immune to this either. I mean, we all see in the media, in our culture, you know, men, scientists portrayed as always being men, and people like Larry Summers at Harvard, you know, who was the president, saying, well, women aren't cut out for science. And, you know, we're getting these messages all the time. And even though you may consciously not want to think that way, on an unconscious level, you can't resist it, and you judge people by things like that, by their gender, by their, you know, what they're wearing, by their race, and so forth.
Well, you know, back to the subconscious mind and the conscious mind, can you train someone to use that subconscious?
Well, there's two things you can do. Yeah, you can be aware of unconscious influences and use your conscious mind to overrule them if you're careful, or you can try to use your unconscious mind also in the most efficient way possible. For instance, your unconscious mind is very good at complicated tasks. You know, again, that's why we have our unconscious mind, is to allow us to not have to stop our life to figure things out that we need to figure out, but to just be able to effortlessly do certain things. So if you give people, like in one experiment, they gave people data. There were two groups of subjects. One group of subjects, they gave them data on a car, and they gave them very simple facts about the car and asked them to decide which car was a better buy. And the other group, they gave them too much information, you know, a tremendous amount of facts, which again, and ask them decide which car is a better buy. And they let them study the facts. Both groups could study the facts, I think, for it was 5 or 10 minutes. And then one group was told, okay, leave that alone now, come here and do another task. I think they played Scrabble or something for 10 minutes. And then they went back to make their decision. The other group, instead of going away, they got 10 more minutes to study this data even more, and use their conscious mind to try and analyze it and spend an extra time thinking about it. And when they were done, the scientists looked at the two groups and looked at who made a better decision. And it was when the data was very simple, the group that studied it consciously made better decisions. When the data was very complicated, the group that took a break made better decisions. And that's because your unconscious mind is working, even though you're taking a break and playing Scrabble or jogging or taking a shower or whatever, you know, doing something physical for a while. If you had been working on a mental task previously, your mind is still cranking away at it. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever had that, George, happen to you, where you're thinking about something and you let it go and then suddenly the answer comes to you.
Sure. Oh, yeah, all the time.
Yeah, right. So what you can do is learn to use your unconscious wisely. So, you know, I learn if I'm, you know, writing or doing a hard physics problem I've been thinking about for a while, I will learn to, like, take a walk, take a break. I'm not going to gain anything. In fact, I'm going to lose something by keeping out another hour right now. I'll gain much more by taking a walk for 20 minutes and letting it settle in, or sleeping on it and then coming back to it. So, you know, if you get clever about how this works, you can use your unconscious to your advantage.
You know, when people judge people by, as we were talking about, body language, posture, what about the voice and what about the physical appearance, the look, the face?
Wow, both of those are very, very important. Let's do voice first. In studies, for instance, they will have someone read a speech that's advocating a certain position. And then the psychologists nowadays, they can use electronics to speed up or slow down the reading without changing the pitch the way that, you know, it used to be in the old days.
Right.
If you sped it up, it got higher pitch. But they could keep the pitch separate, and they could change the speed. Or they can change the pitch, make it deeper voice or a higher voice, you know, and not change the speed. So they could change all these things separately. And what they found was that if a man is speaking with a lower voice, the content of the speech is found to be more persuasive than the same person reading it to, you know, to another group that heard it at a higher voice, heard the person reading the same thing, but the voice was pitched higher. The lower voice will be more persuasive. The faster talker, I mean, within limits, will be more persuasive. The one who speaks really slowly will be tended to be judged as not so intelligent, and so forth. And it has the amount of, you know, how you change your cadence has a big influence on how people judge what you're saying. So the way you say things, the quality of your voice, the pitch, the speed, all affect the way people judge the content of what you're saying. And that's really amazing. And that, again, is something we can't avoid. You can tell someone, I've lowered this person's voice. It's really a higher voice, but I want you to, you know, not be persuaded by that. They can't help but make the judgments based on the voice. In fact, it goes so far as, okay, this is a good study. They had people interact with computers and through a voice, and they found that because if they were reacting to the computer with a voice as opposed to through text, they will exhibit certain qualities of politeness toward the computer as if it were a person. For instance, if a computer tutors them a little bit, and then the computer asks them, how did I do tutoring you? And the people will tend to give an answer, a more positive answer, than if they're interacting with the computer by text. Just like you would if a professor comes up and says, how did I do teaching you? You're not going to say, you don't want to say you stink. So you give a more positive answer. But if you're filling out a paper, you'll give a, you know, maybe a more honest answer if you're anonymous, you know. But if you're interacting with a computer that has a voice, you do the same thing, even though you know you're not going to hurt the computer's feelings. You know that consciously, but unconsciously you can't avoid being swayed by the voice. So that's a little bit about voice.
Well, here's an example, too. Back in the 1960, the Kennedy-Nixon debates, most people that heard the debates on the radio thought Nixon had won the debates. But almost everyone who saw it on television said Kennedy won.
That's right. That's a great example. And, you know, that really hurt Nixon. Nixon actually had been sick. He had a knee infection or something. He had just been campaigning for days.
He was ahead in the polls.
Yeah, he was doing well. But on the day of that debate, he had a 5 o'clock shadow. He looked haggard. And Nixon and Kennedy was fresh. Kennedy also got secretly made up a little bit. Nixon refused the makeup because he thought that was for sissies. And, you know, obviously they were saying the same thing on TV as they were saying on radio, but it had a big difference in the impact that it made. And, okay, as long as we're speaking we can segue to appearance because you asked about how someone looks. There was a great study done at Princeton where a researcher took pairs of black and white photos of the opposing Democrat-Republican candidates from dozens of races around the country. But these were like more obscure races. They were governor races, congressional races, and this was done in Princeton, but these races were outside of New Jersey. So people generally did not know who these people were. They're just seeing photos flashed on the screen, and he asked subjects to come in and just judge which, in each case, in each pair, which person looked more competent, not more beautiful or handsome, but more competent. And then he gathered these statistics, and he predicted the outcomes of those races based purely on which candidate looks more competent. So, you know, some people vote Democrat automatically, Republican, but other people, they think they're taking in this data just like people did in the other study I talked about in the wine aisle. They're looking at the wine. These people are looking at the person's record and their views, and they think they're making a conscious decision. But guess what? 70% of the time, the more competent-looking candidate won the election across the country in 2006. It was amazing.
And that happens, Leonard, time and time again. It is not generally the content. It's how you deliver it.
That's right. And my mother used to say that to me, too. just got to, come off friendly and charming and nice, and you can tell someone anything, right?
That is so, so true. Where do people who want to manipulate other people, maybe governments, how do they use this? Example, let me throw one out, get your reaction to it. The terrorist situation of 9/11, going to the color-coded system. Wasn't that subliminal messaging?
Oh yeah, it was, and they choose the certain colors to scare you. You associate obviously the red with with emergencies and ambulances, and I don't think it worked, but I think they chose their colors carefully there, and the idea being that colors have an effect on your mood and your degree of readiness, I suppose. I don't think people paid much attention to it though.
No.
And it's funny because, from the visual point of view, it's not, red is not the best color for a emergency vehicle because, I think yellowish green is more visible than red, let's say in low light situations, it stands out more. But we traditionally do red because people associate red, have certain associations with it that, you get over time.
Tell me about your thoughts of looking at somebody and telling that they're lying.
That's a very interesting one, and there was a guy named Ekman who started doing a lot of research in the, I think it was the late 80s and early 90s on that, and then he suddenly started to form a company and didn't publish anything else since then. But the claim is that, it's definitely true that your emotions show on your face and you can't help it. I talked about, for instance, when you smile, a fake smile versus a not fake, there are certain things that show on your face that you can't really totally control or very few, the vast majority of people can't. Now, whether you can tell very specifically in a specific instance that someone is lying, that's it's a tougher question because it's one thing to say, well, this person's nervous, this person's disgusted, this person's worried, but to say that this particular sentence that they just said is causing that worry is that's the lie. That's a tough one, but what the claim is, and again, he hasn't really published a lot on this, is that there's these micro expressions that you get, even if you're trying to not show your lie, that your face will for a 20th or a 30th of a second will take on a certain expression, certain muscles will twitch in a certain way that you might not notice when you're in normal interaction, but when he films you, that he can identify by slowing down the film. And so, how much truth there is in that, I'm not sure. And, other scientists are working to use brain imaging to tell when people are lying. That has had limited success. But there's, even the old polygraph was not that bad at telling who's lying. It's just that it's not that great. I forget what the success rate is, and people give different numbers for it. But it's nowhere near what you want, for a court of law. But it's on the other hand, it's also not ridiculously low. So there's different ways people are going at it, and it seems that you do have physiological and facial responses to lying. But it's very hard to jump from, you know, that statement in general to a statement about, you know, your reaction when you say a specific sentence.
Well, I got to tell you, Leonard, it's an incredible science, especially if you can tap into it. But you don't have to be a scientist to use it, do you?
Oh, no, not at all. And, you know, that's why I wrote Subliminal for non-scientists to help just to understand yourself better and to understand what these influences are so that you can use your unconscious mind, you know, to your advantage, or to use your conscious mind, you know, to overrule it in cases where you need to do that.
When you wrote the book, Subliminal, what fascinated you the most about it?
Oh, wow. There are so many things. I think, you know, what got me the most was that when I'm interacting with other people, the idea that I'm not in control of how I'm judging them, that was really, you know, really interesting. And it affects me as I interact with people, you know, still today. Let's take the example we talked about before, prejudice. There's a test, if your listeners want to go there, they can take the test. If you go to Google and you type in IAT, stands for Implicit Association Test, and type in Harvard, because it's Harvard, is the website that will give you the test. You can take a test and to determine your unconscious prejudices. And it's just amazing, the ones that people have. I mean, there are people, you know, black people will show prejudices against black people. There was one famous the gay activist who was shocked that he had prejudices and biases against gay people. These come from being bombarded with stereotypes in our environment, in the media. And what got me in writing the book was to realize, you know, the different ways that I'm judging people, where I think I'm taking into account data that I'm consciously weighing, but that really that there's a lot of unconscious things affecting my judgment, and that I wasn't aware of that. So it's like it opens up a new universe. You know, you're going, oh, you know, before I could only see black and white, and now I see color, and now I see that there's all kinds of other stuff going on that I didn't realize.
Leonard, we're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast with you. We're going to take questions as we talk, of course, about subliminal messaging and also about the work, A Briefer History of Time. We'll be back in a moment with Leonard Mlodinow. Now, if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And do make sure you follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And you can do that by going to our website, far right-hand corner. Just click those two icons, fill out the information, and follow us along.